This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. Their highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Jason Killins about becoming a University Ambulance NHS Trust. So in the conversation, we really wanted to examine what's involved in the application of, and indeed the benefits of becoming an ambulance service NHS Trust affiliated and indeed associated with the university. So as the start of April of this year, the Trust is now known as the Welsh Ambulance Services University NHS Trust. So the sought-after status was granted by the Welsh Government in recognition of WASC's commitment to develop its current and future workforce and indeed to drive research and innovation. So to do this, I have Jason Killins with me. Jason is no stranger to the podcast. He is the Chief Executive of the Welsh Ambulance Services NHS Trust, University NHS Trust, which is the national provider of 909 and indeed 111 and non-emergency patient transport services for Wales. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Good to see you again. Great to be with you.
Jason, I just wonder if we could just start by getting you to speak to the University Trust status and indeed what it means for you and indeed for West.
Yeah, I mean, look, you've touched on some of it in your introduction there, but as you say, we've become a University NHS Ambulance Trust from the 1st of April. That essentially means that Welsh Government or the Cabinet Secretary, the Minister, the Health Minister for Wales has bestowed on us university status. For us, it's a signal of our ongoing, I guess, journey of maturity as an organisation. It's a strong signal of our commitment to the professional development of our people now and in the future, and also to research across the sector. You know, we've got quite an active research team here, led by an assistant director who runs the research team here. We've been quite active for a number of years, and I think you know, whilst this is a title change, if you like, a badge for now, this is the start of the journey, if you like, of a bigger commitment to the ongoing professional development of our people and what we can do in research partnerships to support, you know, the development of practice across the sector. We're the first, almost say the first ambulance university trust in Wales. There's only one because we're a national provider, but we're the second in the UK to become a university ambulance trust. I guess it signals for us not just the name change, but what's to come in the years that follow.
Yeah, indeed. I think what we've spoken about on the podcast before is, I think, fundamentally being a data-driven service, so using data as a baseline to drive service forwards in all domains, emergency and non-emergency and urgent care. And to your point, this puts research and data at the centre of the service, which I think is fantastic because it gives you far more of an argument when you want to drive service improvements. But just looking at the collaborative efforts, Jason, just how much of a collaborative effort has it been and indeed who's been involved?
Yeah, look, I mean, so it's a great question. I mean, this has been work over, you know, many years. It isn't something that we've done in the last fortnight. We've been building up to this for a number of years. And the team here have been working, you know, with Welsh Government, who, to be fair, have been very supportive of the application we made for University Trust status and have supported us through Through the assessment process, because it's not, it's not something that you just write a letter and say, I fancy having, this name change, please. There's a process that we have to step through. But of course, what that's also meant is that we've needed to secure both corporate organizational support willingness, so the trust board, the board being supportive of the journey we're going on, and also develop partnerships, not only with, higher education institutes or with the universities across Wales and beyond those that we would routinely and regularly work with, but also increasingly with industry too. So we've set up a board committee. There's a subcommittee of the board, the Academic Partnerships Committee, which essentially is driving the agenda, driving the kind of research, the development, those partnerships with universities and with industry. It's not a regular governance committee of the board. Yes, it's got an assurance role, but this is more about driving and creating, the future for us as a university trust. So it's been a lot of people that have been involved over a number of years, particular partnerships with government, a creation of an academic partnerships committee as part of our governance structure to drive and lead the activity, but crucially begin to build, and we're only at the start of this journey, those relationships with the unis across Wales, universities across Wales, and industry.
So like you said, I think to say it's been a lot of work is probably an understatement, and as you say, it's been years and years of collaborative work. But something which we wanted to dig into was really these three main pillars of evidence, really, this the research and development, the training and education, and indeed the innovation. Could you maybe speak to these sort of three main pillars and how the Trust has sort of evidenced progress on each of these?
Yeah, I mean, so look, the research and development, I guess, is one to start on. There's an NHS Wales research and development framework made up of 10 pillars, which we've had to, demonstrate evidence against, and we will use, as we go on this journey now as a university trust status. Those 10 pillars will probably be no surprise to you, but governance and leadership, partnerships and collaboration, research support, research delivery, finance that obviously underpins it all, workforce, so NHS workforce capacity and capability, public involvement and participation in what we're doing, communications and engagement, and then the impact of that. So you've got this range of pillars in this NHS Wales R&D framework, which we sign up to and will use now to, I guess, guide us on the journey over the coming years. Training and education, I think, for us now, this is more about our commitment to training and education for our people. We've clearly, like all other ambulance services across the UK, been recruiting university direct entrants for a number of years now, and we've had partnerships with two universities. We've got partnerships with two universities in Wales now that provide direct entrant paramedics through those programs. But of course, for us, particularly with the advent of advanced practice in recent years, we've got programs which are run, MSc programs which are run by other unis, beyond those two across Wales. And those are bespoke programs, arguably, for us. So the status, if you like, university trust status, gives us a bit more opportunity to influence the content of those programs as they're created. We commission those directly with those universities. And of course, we're proud of the fact, that we fund here in Wales, we fully fund scores of MSc programs for our people every year. So that sets us apart a bit from other trusts, other ambulance trusts across the UK, in that we fully fund those programs, both in terms of the fees, but also supporting with release time. And there's two options for people in that. There's a part-time program over 36 months, or a full-time program, which we'll release people for over 12. So it's just, perhaps one example of the commitment we've got to development of our people. We put our money where our mouth is, and turn the words into actions. And then that final area there, you touched on innovation. Probably a couple of examples I could point to that are live now. We've got a partnership with a firm called Lucy to deploy wearables in the community, so remote monitoring wearables. So these will be going out into communities with patients that we will be holding, awaiting a response or referral to another bit of the system. And our clinicians back in our contact centers will be monitoring those patients. So we've got this kind of innovation, wearables pilot going on. You probably would have seen, perhaps on some social media, listeners would have seen on some social media posts recently, some stuff about drones. We're looking to pilot the use of drones to deploy defibrillators to cardiac arrests in rural and remote patches. We're partnered with an industry provider to look at different ways of heating and cooling the rear of an ambulance. So this is a an issue that's come up for us with pressure across urgent emergency care. Is it relating or resulting in delays, handover delays in the winter or in the summer? We need to run engines for heating or cooling in the saloon. That creates a problem with fumes. So we're partnered with a supplier in industry to create a different way to heat, cool, and ventilate the back of the vehicles. And the first kind of cut of that stuff will be coming off the production line soon. So there's just a couple of examples there where we're being a bit creative and thinking differently about some of the challenges that we've got in the sector and how we could respond to them.
Yeah, listen, that's fantastic. And like I said, plenty of linkages at multiple points to drive service improvement. And one of the things you just said there, which was really interesting, is education isn't just fundamental to grassroots clinicians. It actually meets clinicians all the way through their journey. And like you said, integrating that within the trust. So MSc level, BSc level, and even indeed PhD level. It's actually meeting the clinician at each stage of their journey. And I think one of the, and I'd be really keen to get your perspectives on this, Jason, is, there's always been a dearth and a lack of research within post-op care. And one of the aspects of doing an MSc and or indeed a PhD is the generation of indeed high quality empirical literature, empirical research. Could you maybe speak to, and this all brings it back to being a data-driven service, actually. So you're starting to generate a lot more research, which is homegrown, which is integral in WAST, and starting to look at various areas of service improvement through data, through research. How can you use that, and what have you seen or seeing that you can really harness through research to push the service forward?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's probably loads you could go at there. I mean, but most ambulance services, having worked in a couple, most ambulance services are, we describe ourselves as data rich but intelligence poor, don't we? So we've got loads of stuff, loads of numbers and loads of stuff, but we haven't been too great in the recent past in turning that stuff, that data into intelligence where we can make informed management decisions or choices. And of course, that's true of research too, as you say. Whilst there is some areas of the pre-hospital space where there's lots of research, in the ambulance sector, there's not a great amount. Certainly in some topics, and we're finding that now with changes we want to make the next iteration of our clinical model here, and changes we want to make later in the year. When you look at available research and you kind of do a lit review, there's not a lot in the kind of pre-hospital emergency EMS medical services kind of triage space. And so arguably we're beginning to generate some of our own as a result of kind of tests of change and the work that we're doing. So I think whilst there's lots of data, this the journey we're going on, the 10 pillars to the NHS Wales research and development framework, will help us, will guide us to create more evidence, research, which will be not only of use to us in the work that we do, but also, to the sector across the UK and indeed internationally, given that, in many EMS services, the model of delivery is largely the same, whether you're in the UK, whether you're in Australia, or other places. So we think it's an exciting time, and we're ready to play our part, I guess, with with creating that evidence for change and improvement and innovation across the sector.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jason. And I think one of the exciting things, like you said as well, is I think utilizing and indeed promoting homegrown talent. So people within the service which are developing a thirst or a desire for research. And like you said, it's not even about the data, it's about the interpretation of the data and harnessing that for the better. Another aspect which is really fascinating about becoming University Ambulance NHS Trust is that you can start to reach into the universities and start to bring specialists to indeed lecture and indeed maybe even consult within the ambulance service. We have had Kalichi Noham on the podcast, and he's the director of public health for one of the health Welsh health boards. A fantastic mind on public health, and I think just the affiliation of closer ties with universities is me. Anyone who's been in Prithpl Care for a while knows actually public health is such a large part of a fundamental part of Prithpl Care. Could you maybe speak to some of the sort of the wider contacts that you could resource and or are resourcing within universities just to bring them into even through these subcommittees to get some of these fundamental characters and people onto these subcommittees to consult and indeed to feed into strategy within West?
Yeah, so I mean, so one of the things in addition to this academic partnerships committee I spoke about, you know, this subcommittee of the board, which is driving the activity around university trust status for us now, one of the things that we have to do as part of the approvals process is have an academic non-executive director. So listeners, you know, people listening to the podcast, you know, will probably be familiar that you know, ambulance services in the UK are governed by trust boards. The composition of those varies dependent on whether you're an NHS trust or a foundation trust. But essentially, it's got, you know, salaried directors and non-executive directors, which are, you know, on day rates normally. And they form part of the scrutiny and kind of oversight and governance process of the organisation, not just in the ambulance sector, but in health providers more generally in the NHS. So for us as a university trust, we have to have an academic NED, so a non-executive director that is closely associated and working in academia. So of course, what that does is that draws in not only the institution that that person happens to work for, but also their network and the other unis too. So that kind of requirement on us certainly helps us. In the public health space, to the second part of your question, I mean, we've already got a public health plan as an organisation, and I think you're right to touch on this because it's an area that the ambulance sector hasn't really been close to until the last couple of years. You know, organisations across the UK have started to develop public health plans, but there is quite a lot, particularly in the prevention space, that you can think about that we can get into to support people in our communities staying healthy and well for longer. So there's something about resilient communities. There's something about that prevention. There's definitely a role for us in prevention, in recognition, in signposting patients to services. It's almost the mantra of making every contact count, which comes in here. And you know, we're not going to do anything extravagant with our public health plan, certainly for the first couple of years. But having a plan that recognises that we have a role to play in keeping people well, particularly with an ageing population, particularly in rural and remote communities where access to other bits of the health system is hard, and where we're going into people's homes, we're in that privileged position of going into people's homes and seeing stuff, not just in the emergency service, but, you know, as you mentioned, we operate as other services do too in the UK. We operate non-emergency transport too, and then you couple that with 111, and you think about, well, where's this wearable pilot thing that we're doing going to go? You know, what information are we going to be able to access off the patient's Apple Watch, say, in the future? How's that going to connect to the NHS app? What are we going to be able to do with that? There's a whole load of stuff that starts, you can see, oh, you know, this starts to become connections there, which in the public health arena could be very useful for identifying conditions and keeping people healthy. That makes sense.
No, it does. It absolutely does. And like you said, joined up thinking in the background with let's say evidence-based change from a incremental perspective on public health, like and absolutely wearables, it trended data over time. We can start to predict health crises before the COPD is one of them, and high blood pressure, and so on and so forth. And so it does absolutely make sense. One of the so shifting the spectrum really to from preventative health to actually interventional health when things have gone wrong. I think another facet of becoming university NHS trust for me that's really fascinating is that for at BSc and MSc level, and even at PhD level, is looking at the interventions which the ambulance service that WASDA are bringing patients into, the stroke network data, the PCI data, the trauma network data, starting to analyze this data, see the weaknesses and the strengths, and emphasize the strengths and actually then focus on the weaknesses. Could you maybe speak to, because I mean, stroke and PCI and trauma are three sort of fundamental networks within Wales, all of which can always be iterated and actually benefit from research. Could you maybe speak to how you can sort of focus on those?
Yeah, I mean, so clearly, as you would expect, you know, we play a part in all of those clinical networks. I mean, if I think particularly about stroke and perhaps, you know, the connection to university status and in innovation, we've had some work going on in Cardiff and the Vale, you know, using telemetry. This is not new technology, but you know, using telemetry to improve access and pathways for stroke patients. That's shown some great results for those patients, and you know, live discussions underway about how we roll that out nationally. We've been doing some stuff with AI in the background in call handling. You know, so can we use AI to predict better what the outcome of a 9999 call is going to be, from language, you know, inflection, all those kind of things that are going on in the caller's voice, not just what they say, but you know, how can AI help us enhance the call handling process, and particularly the triage decisions that we make. And we've also through partnerships with others, not necessarily in trauma, but I'll go to end of life patients, palliative care patients. You know, we've got we've developed a cadre of specialist palliative care paramedics that others have across the UK too, but that's in partnership with others across the health sector here. So yeah, there's a range of different examples of us being more than just an ambulance service now, you know. So we are, you know, we do emergency medical care, we do emergency ambulances, and we'll always continue to do that. But it's not the sole part of what an NHS ambulance service is now. And increasingly, my own view increasingly is that will always remain a part that we have to do, and we have to do it well, and we should do it well. But increasingly, we'll be developing with other health organisations, and arguably, you know, potentially in social care. So with local authorities, potentially in social care, but certainly with industry, we'll be creating different services on a local kind of commissioned regional basis to respond to challenges and patient need in those communities, partly because we can recruit and retain people. Other bits of the NHS can't. You know, we don't have a shortage of paramedics coming out of universities here in Wales. We've got more coming out of our unis than we generally recruit each year. I know some trusts in England, you know, that's not the case, that the position they find themselves in, but we can recruit and retain people, and with growing partnerships with universities, we can educate and train our people to do different things. And that's quite exciting, I think, because it offers great opportunity for our people to grow, continue to grow professionally, but also work in different settings.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jason. And to your point, actually, it's not actually like you said, to be controversial, but to align with your point, actually, it's not, it's no longer ambulatory care. What it is care at scene that fits into a network and actually that is streamed appropriately. And it's fundamentally, it's more pre-hospital care, because whether it's ambulatory or not, it may be care at home, it may be referral care to another, it may be it just may be checking up on people, it may be remote monitoring. It's not necessarily just this ambulance or ambulatory care anymore. It's far more democratized, it's far more networked than
absolutely right. We have to think differently. We people like me and the sector have to think differently. You know, I was having a conversation today with some people here. You know, we're used to going to a scene and conveying a patient, or if we don't convey a patient, you know, we might have sent a community responder or someone in a solo paramedic or a technician in a car, you know, and they'll wait there for however long it is until we get an ambulance to convey the patient. Well, why do we need to do that? You know, in the new world, if the patient is stable, why do we need to stay? Particularly if we're queuing responses, you know, we're waiting for patients to we've got patients waiting for a response. And with the technology, and think about wearables, well, we can send a volunteer out with some kit, deploy the wearables on the patient, and you know, every hour or every half hour or whatever it is we set it up for, it sends us back a bunch of you know, vital signs, and if they step out of the thresholds we've agreed, we can intervene. But otherwise, why would we need to be waiting? This kind of innovation and this kind of, I don't like the phrase out of the box, but different thinking about how to solve the problem that we've got opens up all sorts of doors and opportunities for us.
So Jason, what does university status do in regards to sort of recruitment and retention of maybe recruitment of international paramedics and indeed retention? How does it facilitate? I think it will. I think it absolutely does. But could you maybe speak to it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of, there's probably a couple of things I'd say here, and I think they're soft. Yeah, so there's kind of soft, almost intangible things, which I think come as benefits as a result of being a university trust, a university ambulance trust. It differentiates us from others. You know, we're only the second in the UK to be a university trust, so I think that it differentiates us. From a reputation perspective, it kind of says, oh, they're doing some different stuff. You know, they're thinking differently. They're doing some different stuff. They're on a progressive journey, not only you know, with education and training and development for their people, but as an organisation. One example, actually, again, a recent one. You know, I mentioned the kind of social media coverage on the drones. You know, someone that came on the back of like 2 days before we'd announced we were, you know, going to be a university trust, and someone in the EMS field in a service outside the UK. It's only one tweet, but it's just symbolic, I think, of what the kind of soft influence this starts to have. Said, you know, tweeted back and basically said, "Well, is there anything in Wales that they ain't doing?" You know, and it just kind of, I think that the badge, it's more than a badge, it's symbolic of the culture, I guess, that we're creating here, which is about continually looking for the next best thing to do to improve the experience in the workplace for our people and to improve access, outcomes and experience for patients. Not sitting still, not sitting on our hands, continually looking for the next thing.
Absolutely, Jason, absolutely. And I think one of the things I just touch on as we start to come into land is, as you said, you know, a fully funded MSc opened doors for me, actually. Mine wasn't fully funded, but there was some funding, and it was all in my own time, but there was opportunity. I knew there would be opportunity doing an MSc. Opening doors you can't even see yet, and unlocking potential and indeed opportunities down the road, and so to that point, putting training and education at the heart of the service, becoming a university ambulance NHS trust. Could you speak to that commitment to, because education does open doors, fundamentally opens doors. Could you speak to sort of how that plays into encouraging maybe even more staff to join WAST and indeed develop their own skills through not sitting still, through that continual progression?
Yeah, I mean, look, we... Yeah, most people listening will know, you know, my background. You know, I didn't come through the uni route. You know, I joined as a, you know, joined the job nearly 30 years ago as a direct entry QAP or technician, as it is now. And I didn't do a paramedic course and I didn't go on to university. So I'm saying all this as a kind of a direct entry vocational guy. But increasingly, we don't know what we don't know, do we? You know, as individuals, we don't know what we don't know. And we maintain here a strong commitment to develop our people as far as their talents will take them. Yeah. So if someone wants to, you know, someone joins as a volunteer, and they want to progress through to be a paramedic or go into education or go into senior leadership, you know, we're going to do everything we can to help those people do that. And we over a number of years, you know, we've started to create the structures and I guess environment which enables and permits that. Education of our people is something we're committed to. For me, creating an environment, creating an organisation, having an organisation where people are constantly challenged. I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean challenged in thinking to develop and progress. Creates good outcomes, I think, and you see that with our people that are progressing through. If I think about, you know, people that have come through the direct entry technician route and have gone on our paramedic conversion pathway, and you know, I talk to some of those people when they've finished their paramedic program, you know, it's a massive achievement for them. And then we've got people going on to do MSCs after that. They never thought, you know, when they joined 10, 15 years ago, didn't even know what it was. And now they're hungry for it. It creates an environment where people are hungry for development.
Yeah, which is a great place to be, absolute great place to be. Just finally, as we come into land, actually, Jason, there will be a lot of eyes on WAST because, like you said, you are so progressive as a leadership team and as indeed as a trust, as a whole body of staff. Could you maybe speak to some take-home points that you'd advocate to possibly other trusts that might be looking to do similar?
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably two or three things. One is that you've got to have your whole leadership team's got to be behind it. You know, your board, so your salaried, your directors, your non-executive directors, the board, the leadership team, particularly the clinical team, senior clinical team, have got to be behind it. You've got to, see it, the acquisition of the badge, you've got to see that as the start of the journey. Not that's not the end point, that's just the start. And I think you've got to be open to importing practice, best practice from other places. So if you've got a culture which is got an organizational culture which is closed to adopting with pride what works in other places, then university status probably isn't for you. But if you're open to recognizing that you can do better by using the experiences of others, and you've got the support of your senior clinical team and the board, then it's a good thing to do.
Listen, that's fantastic. And that's a fantastic place to finish. Listen, thank you so much for your time, Jason. I always value talking to you and getting your insights. So thank you.
No worries. Good to see you.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.